Stop and think for 20 seconds first. Treat it as a real choice. The sort of reasonableness where you realize I'm offering a way to protect the other girls, and that if you automatically say no without considering it properly, there's this actual consequence where Hannah Abbott ends up in the hospital.
Hermione stared at Harry as his recitation wound down.
Well, said Harry, I shouldn't have to make promises,
she said.
Just to be consulted about my own life.
She turned from Harry and began walking toward the Ravenclaw Tower, not looking at him.
But I'll think about it anyway.
She heard Harry sigh, and after that they walked in silence for a while, passing through an archway of some reddish metal like copper, into a corridor that was just like the one they'd left, except that it was tiled in pentagons instead of squares.
Hermione, said Harry, I've been watching you and thinking, since the day you said you were going to be a hero. You've got the courage. You'll fight for what's right, even in the face of enemies that would scare other people away. You've certainly got the raw intelligence for it, and you're probably a better person inside than I am. But even so, well, to be honest, Hermione, I can't quite see you filling Dumbledore's shoes, leading magical Britain's fight against you-know-who. Not yet, anyway.
Hermione had turned her head to stare at Harry, who just went on walking as though lost in thought. Fill those shoes? She'd never tried to imagine herself that way. She'd never imagining herself that way.
And maybe I'm wrong, Harry said as they walked. Maybe I've just read too many stories where the heroes never do the sensible thing and follow the rules and tell their Professor McGonagalls. So my brain doesn't think you're a proper storybook hero. Maybe it's you who's the sane one, Hermione, and me who's just being silly. But every time you talk about following rules or relying on teachers, I get that same feeling. Like it's bound to end up with this one last thing that's stopping you. One last thing that puts your PC self to sleep and turns you into an NPC again.
Harry let out a sigh.
Maybe that's why Dumbledore said I should have wicked step-parents.
He said what?
Harry nodded.
I still don't know whether the headmaster was joking or... The thing is, he was right, in a way. I had loving parents, but I never felt like I could trust their decisions. They weren't sane enough. I always knew that if I didn't think things through myself, I might get hurt. Professor McGonagall will do whatever it takes to get the job done if I'm there to nag her about it. She doesn't break rules on her own without heroic supervision. Professor Quirrell really is someone who gets things done no matter what. And he's the only other person I know who notices stuff like the Snitch ruining Quidditch. But him, I can't trust to be good. Even if it's sad, I think that's part of the environment that creates what Dumbledore calls a hero. People who don't have anyone else to shove final responsibility onto, and that's why they form the mental habit of tracking everything themselves.
Hermione didn't say anything to that, but she was thinking back to something Godric Gryffindor had written near the end of his very short autobiography. Briefly, and without any explanation, because the scroll had been meant to be copied by hand, centuries before the Muggle printing press had inspired wizards to invent the reading writing quill. "No rescuer hath the rescuer," Godric Gryffindor had written. "No lord hath the champion, no mother and no father, only nothingness above." If that was the price of being a hero, Hermione wasn't sure she wanted to pay it. Or maybe, though it wasn't the sort of thing she'd have thought before she started hanging around Harry, maybe Godric Gryffindor had gotten it wrong.
"Do you trust Dumbledore?"
Hermione said.
"I mean, he's right here in our school, and he's the most legendary hero in the whole world."
"He was the most legendary hero," said Harry. "Now he sets chickens on fire. Honestly, does Dumbledore seem reliable to you?"
Hermione didn't answer. Side by side, the two of them began to climb huge, wide spiral stairs, the steps alternating between bronze metal and blue stone, the final approach to where the Ravenclaw portrait waited to guard their dorm with silly riddles.
"Oh, and I just thought of something I should tell you," Harry said when they were about halfway up. "Since it affects your life and all, think of it as a sort of down payment."
"What is it?"
said Hermione.
"I predict Spew is about to retire."
"Retire?"
Hermione said, almost stumbling on one of the stairs.
Yeah, Harry said. "I mean, I could be wrong, but I suspect the teachers are about to clamp down hard on fighting in the corridors."
Harry was grinning as he spoke, a glint in his eyes behind the glasses, hinting at secret knowledge.
Cast new wards to detect offensive hexes, or start verifying reports of bullying using Veritaserum. I can think of several ways they might shut it down. But if I'm right, it's something to celebrate, Hermione. You, and all of you, you kicked up enough public ruckus that you got them to actually do something about the bullying. All the bullying."
Slowly, then, a smile began to creep up her lips, and as she reached the top of the stairs and began walking toward the Ravenclaw portrait for her riddle, Hermione felt rather lighter on her feet, a wonderful lifting feeling spreading through her like she had been pumped full of helium. Somehow, despite all the effort the eight of them had put in, she hadn't expected that much. She hadn't expected it to actually work. They'd made a difference. It was the end of breakfast time on the next morning. The students from every year sat very still in their benches, all heads turned in the same direction, toward the head table, before which one lone first-year girl stood rigid and motionless, her head tilted back to stare up at the head of House Slytherin. Professor Snape's face was twisted with fury and triumph, vindictive as any painting of a dark wizard, and behind him the other professors sat at the head table, watching with faces as though carved from stone.
"Permanently disbanded,"
spat the potions master.
"Your self-proclaimed society is outlawed within Hogwarts by my decision as a professor. If your society or any member of it is discovered fighting in the hallways again, Granger, you will be personally held responsible and expelled by me from the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry."
That first year girl stood there, before the head table where she'd been called before only to receive commendations and smiles. Stood there, with her spine held tall and upright in its curve like a centaur's bow, giving nothing to the enemy. That first year witch stood there, with all tears and anger bottled up, her face still, nothing changing of her outward appearance, while something slowly broke inside her. She could feel it breaking. It broke further when Professor Snape gave her 2 weeks' detention for the crimes of violence in school, sneering with the contemptuous face he'd shown them all on the first day of potions, and with a little twist in the corner of his smile that said the potions master knew exactly how unfair he was being. Whatever it was inside her cracked all the way through, from top to bottom, when Professor Snape took 100 points from Ravenclaw. It ended then, and Snape told her she was dismissed. She turned around and saw that at the Ravenclaw table, Harry Potter was sitting still in his place. She couldn't see his expression from here. She saw his fists on the table, but she couldn't see if they were clenched white like her own. She had whispered to him, when Professor Snape had called her, that he wasn't to do anything without asking first. Hermione wheeled back again to look at the head table, just as Snape was turning away from her to resume his place.
"I said you're dismissed, girl," said the sneering voice, but there was a pleased smile on Snape's face, like he was waiting for her to do something.
Hermione strode forward another 5 steps toward the head table and said in a breaking voice,
"Headmaster?"
Utter silence filled the great hall. Headmaster Dumbledore said nothing. Didn't move. It was as if he too were just carved from stone. Hermione turned her gaze to look at Professor Flitwick, whose head, barely visible above the table, seemed to be staring down into his lap. Beside him, Professor Sprout's face was very tight. She seemed to be forcing herself to watch, and her lips were trembling, but she said nothing. Professor McGonagall's chair was empty. The deputy headmistress hadn't shown up to breakfast that morning.
"Why aren't any of you saying anything?"
said Hermione Granger. Her voice was trembling with the last of her hope, the last desperate reach for help from that place inside her.
"You know what he's doing is wrong."
2 more weeks' detention for insolence," Snape said silkily.
It shattered. Hermione looked at the head table for a few seconds longer, at Professor Flitwick and Professor Sprout, and the empty place where Professor McGonagall should have been. Then Hermione Granger turned and began walking toward the Ravenclaw table. There was a babble of voices starting up as the students came unfroze from where they'd sat. And then, as she was almost to the Ravenclaw table, the dry voice of Professor Quirrell cut through everything. And that voice said,
100 points to Miss Granger for doing what is right.
Hermione almost fell over her own feet. And then she continued forward, even as Snape shouted something furious, even as Professor Quirrell leaned back in his chair and began to laugh, even as Dumbledore's voice was saying something she didn't catch, and then she was sitting down at the Ravenclaw table again next to Harry Potter. Harry Potter was frozen beside her. He looked like someone who didn't dare move.
"It's all right,"
her voice said to him, automatically, without there being any choice or thought involved, although really it wasn't all right at all.
"But can you see if you can get me out of Snape's detentions, like you did yourself that time?"
Harry Potter nodded, a single jerky motion of his head.
"I," said Harry. "I'm sorry, this is all my fault."
"Don't be ridiculous."
It was odd how her voice was coming out all normal, and without her thinking about what to say. Hermione looked down at her breakfast plate, but eating seemed to be clearly out of the question. There was a roiling and churning in her stomach which suggested that she was already on the verge of throwing up, which was odd because she could have sworn her whole body felt numb, like she wasn't feeling anything at the same time.
"And,"
her voice said,
"if you want to break school rules or something, you can ask me about it. I promise I won't just say no."
"Non est salvatori salvator, necce defensori dominas, nec pater nec mater, nihil supernum."
Godric Gryffindor, 1202 CE. Chapter 76. Interlude with the Confessor. Sunk costs. Rhian Felthorn descended the stairs of roughened stone and crude mortar, keeping a lumos lit through the distances between fire sconces, holding aloft her wand through the gaps from light to light. She came to the empty rock cavern, pierced by many dark openings, lit by a torch of ancient style that fired as she entered. There was no one else there, as yet, and after long minutes of nervous standing, she began the spell to transfigure a cushioned sofa large enough for two people to sit, or maybe even lie down on. A simple wooden stool would have been easier. She could have done that in 15 seconds, but, well... Even when the sofa was fully conjured, Professor Snape still hadn't arrived, and she sat down on the left side of her sofa with her pulse hammering in her throat. Somehow, she was only becoming more nervous, not less, as the delay stretched. She knew this was the last time. The last time before all these memories went away, and Rhian Felthorn found herself in a mysterious cavern, wondering what was going on. There was something about it that felt like dying. The book said a properly done abbreviation wasn't harmful. People forgot things all the time. People dreamed, and then woke up without remembering their dreams. Abbreviation didn't even involve that much discontinuity, just a brief instant of disorientation. It was like being distracted by a loud noise and losing track of a thought you couldn't seem to remember afterward. That was what the book said, and why memory charms were fully approved by the Ministry for all authorized governmental purposes. But still, these thoughts, the thoughts she was thinking right now, soon, nobody would have them anymore. When she looked ahead in the future, there was nobody to complete the thought she wasn't finished thinking. Even if she managed to tie up all the loose ends in her mind over the next minute, there wouldn't be anything left of it afterward. Wasn't that exactly what you would find yourself reflecting on, if you were going to die in the next minute? There came the sound of muffled steps. Severus Snape emerged into the cavern. His eyes moved to her sitting on the sofa, and a strange expression crossed his face. Strange because it wasn't sardonic, or angry, or cold.
"Thank you, Miss Felthorn," Snape said quietly. "That was considerate of you."
The potions master took out his wand and performed the usual privacy charms, and then he moved toward her, and sat down heavily beside her on the transfigured sofa. Her pulse was now pounding for another reason entirely. She slowly turned to look at Professor Snape, and saw that his head was leaning back against the sofa, and his eyes were closed. Not sleeping, though. His face appeared tense, unrelaxed, bearing pain. She knew, she was suddenly certain, that she was only allowed to see this sight because she wouldn't remember it afterward, and that nobody before her had ever been allowed to see it. The frantic conversation going on inside Rhianne Felthorne's mind sounded something like this.
"I could just lean over and kiss him. You're completely out of your tiny mind. His eyes are closed. I bet he wouldn't stop me in time. I bet it would be years before anyone found your body."
But Professor Snape opened his eyes then, to her inner disappointment and relief, and said in a more normal voice,
"Your payment, Miss Felthorne."
From his robe he took a ruby, cut to Gringotts standards, and held it out toward her.
50 facets? I will not mind if you count them."
She held out a trembling hand, hoping that Snape would press the ruby into her fingers, that she would feel a touch of his skin alive against hers. But instead, Snape raised his hand slightly and dropped the ruby into her hand, then leaned back against the couch.
"You will remember finding it lying on the ground of this cavern, where you came exploring," said Snape. "And since nobody except you will actually believe that, you will remember thinking that it would be less troublesome if you deposited the money into a separate box in Gringotts."
For a stretch, there was only the faint crackling of the torch.
"Why?"
Rhianne Felthorne said.
"He knows I won't remember. Why did you do it? I mean, you said to tell you where bullies would be, and who they would be, but not whether Granger would be there. And I know the way the time turner works. If you want to make Granger be there, you can't be told whether it's already happened. So I did work out that we were the ones telling her where to go. We were, weren't we?"
Snape nodded without speaking. He had closed his eyes again.
"But," said Rhianne, "I didn't understand why you were helping her. And now, after what you did to Granger in the Great Hall, I just don't understand at all."
Rianne had never thought of herself as particularly nice. She'd taken little notice of the controversy over the Sunshine General, but something about helping Granger fight bullies had... well, she'd gotten used to thinking of that as the good side, and thinking of herself as being on the good side. And she'd found she'd actually liked it. It was hard to just let that go.
"Why do you do that, Professor Snape?"
Snape shook his head. His face tightened.
"Is..."
Rianne said falteringly.
"I mean, so long as we're here, is there anything you do want to talk about?"
There was something she wanted to say, but she couldn't make the words pass her own lips.
"I can think of one matter," Snape said after a pause, "if you are interested, Miss Felthorn."
Snape's eyes were still shut, so she couldn't just nod her head. Her voice almost broke when she forced herself to say,
"Yes."
"There is a certain boy in your class who likes you, Miss Felthorn," Snape said from behind his closed eyes. "I won't say his name, but he watches you every time you walk across the room when he thinks you aren't looking. He dreams about you and desires to possess you, but he never asks you for so much as a kiss."
Her heart started hammering even harder.
"Please tell me the honest truth, Miss Felthorn. What do you think of that boy?"
"Well,"
she said, she was stumbling over her words,
"I think to never even ask for one kiss would be...
sad.
Just too pitiful. Weakness,"
she said, her voice trembling.
"I agree," said Snape. "Suppose that boy had helped you, though. Would you think that you owed him a kiss, if he asked?"
She inhaled sharply.
"Or would you think," Snape continued, his eyes still closed, "that he was just being bothersome?"
The words stabbed into her like a knife, and she couldn't help gasping out loud. Snape's eyes flew open, and his gaze met hers across the sofa. Then the potions master began to laugh, small, sad chuckles.
"No, not you, Miss Felthorn," Snape said. "Not you. We really are talking about a boy. One who attends your potions class, in fact."
"Oh,"
she said. She tried to remember what Snape had said before, now feeling rather unnerved as she thought of some boy watching her, always silently watching.
"Well, in that case... that's kind of creepy, actually. Who is it?"
The potions master shook his head.
"It doesn't matter," said Snape. "Out of curiosity, what would you think if that boy were still in love with you years later?"
She said, feeling a bit confused.
"That would be totally pathetic."
The torch crackled a bit in the cavern.
"It's strange," Snape said quietly. "I have had two mentors over the course of my days. Both were extraordinarily perceptive and neither one ever told me the things I wasn't seeing. It's clear enough why the first said nothing, but the second...
Snape's face tightened.
I suppose I would have to be naive to ask why he stayed silent.
The quiet stretched, while Rianne tried frantically to think of something to say.
It is an odd thing,
Snape said, his voice still softer.
To look back after only 32 years, and wonder when your life was ruined past all rescuing. Was it determined when the Sorting Hat cried, "Slytherin," for me? It seems unfair, since I was offered no choice. The Sorting Hat spoke the moment it touched upon my head. Yet I cannot claim it named me untruly. I never treasured knowledge for its own sake. I was not loyal to the one person I called friend. I was never one for righteous fury, then or now. Courage? There is no bravery in risking a life already ruined. My little fears have always mastered me, and I never turned aside from any of the paths I walked down for those little fears. No, the Sorting Hat could never have put me in her house. Perhaps my final loss was determined even then. Is that fair, I ask, even if the Sorting Hat speaks truly? Is it fair that some children should possess more courage than others, and thus a man's life be judged?
Rianne Felthorn was starting to realize that she'd never had the tiniest inkling of who her potions master was inside, and unfortunately, all these dark, hidden depths weren't helping her with her problem.
But no, Snape said. I know where it went wrong for the last time. I could point to the very day and hour I missed my final chance. Miss Felthorn, did the Sorting Hat offer you Ravenclaw?
Yes,
she said without thinking.
Have you ever been any good at riddles?
Yes,
she said again, because whatever Professor Snape was about to say, she wouldn't hear it if she said no.
I'm terrible at riddles,
Snape said in a distant voice.
I was once given a riddle to solve, and I did not understand even the simplest part until too late. I did not even realize the riddle was meant for me until too late. I thought I had merely happened to overhear it, when in truth it was I who was overheard. So I sold my riddle to another, and that is when the wreckage of my life passed beyond retrieval.
Snape's voice was still distant, sounding more abstracted than sorrowful.
And even now, I understand nothing of importance. Tell me, Miss Felthorn, suppose a man were carrying a knife, and he tripped over a baby and stabbed himself. Would you say that the baby had...
Snape's voice lowered, as though he were imitating some still deeper voice.
"The power to vanquish him?"
No,
she said hesitantly.
"Then what does it mean to have the power to vanquish someone?"
Rhiann considered the puzzle, wishing, not for the first time in her life, that she had chosen Ravenclaw and to perdition with her parents' disapproval. But the Sorting Hat had never offered her Gryffindor.
"Well,"
Rhiann said. She was having trouble putting her thoughts into words.
"Means you've got the power, but you don't have to do it. It means you could do it if you tried."
"Choice,"
the potions master said in the same faraway voice, as though he wasn't really talking to her at all.
"There will be a choice. That is what the riddle seems to imply, and that choice is not a foregone conclusion to the chooser, for the riddle does not say will vanquish, but rather the power to vanquish. How would a grown man mark a baby as his equal?"
"What?"
said Rhiann. She didn't understand that at all.
"Marking a baby is simple. Any strong, dark curse would produce a lasting scar, but such may be done to any child. What mark would signify that a baby was your equal?"
She answered with the first thought that came to mind.
"If you signed a betrothal contract, that would mean you'd be equals with them someday, when they grew up and you got married."
"That," said Snape, "that's probably not it, Miss Felthorn, but thank you for trying."
The long, delicate fingers, honed by stirring potions to unimaginable fine tolerances, reached up and rubbed at the temples of the man's forehead.
"It is enough to drive me to madness. So much hinging on such fragile words. Power he knows not. It must be more than some unknown spell, not something he could acquire simply by practice and study. Some innate talent. No one can learn to be a metamorph magus. And yet that hardly seems like a power he knows not. Nor can I see how either could destroy all but a remnant of the other. I can see it in one direction, but not the reverse."
The potions master sighed.
"And none of this means anything to you, does it, Miss Felthorn? The words are nothing. The words are shadows. It is her intonation which carries the meaning, and that is something I've never been able to..."
The potions master trailed off while Rhiann stared at him.
"A prophecy?"
Rhiann said in a high squeak.
"You heard a prophecy?"
She'd taken divination for a couple of months before dropping it in disgust, and she knew that much about how it worked.
"I will try one last thing," said Snape. "Something I have not tried before. Miss Felthorne, listen to the sound of my voice. The way I say it, not the words themselves, and tell me what you think it means. Can you do that?"
"Good," said Snape, as she nodded obediently, though she wasn't sure at all what she was supposed to do. And Severus Snape drew a breath and intoned,
"For those two different spellets cannot exist in the same world."
It sent shivers down her spine, all the worse for knowing the hollow words had been spoken in imitation of a true prophecy. Unnerved, she blurted out the first thing which came to mind, which might have been influenced by her present company.
"Those two different ingredients cannot exist in the same cauldron?"
"But why not, Miss Felthorne? What is the meaning of a statement like that? What are we really being told?"
She hesitated.
"If the two ingredients mix, they'll catch fire and burn in the cauldron?"
Snape's face did not change expression in the slightest.
"Perhaps,"
Snape finally said, after they'd sat on the sofa in awful silence for what seemed like minutes.
"It would explain the word must. Thank you, Miss Felthorne. Once again, you have been most helpful."
"I..."
she said.
"I was glad to..."
And the word stuck in her throat. The potions master had thanked her with a tone of finality, and she knew that the time of the Rhian Felthorne who remembered these moments was drawing to an end.
"I wish I didn't have to forget this, Professor Snape."
"I wish,"
Severus Snape said in a whisper so low she could hardly hear it,
"that everything had been different."
The potions master stood up from the sofa, the weight of his presence vanishing from beside her. He turned and drew his wand from his robes, pointing it at her.
"Wait,"
she said.
"Before that..."
Somehow, it was unbelievably hard to take the first step from fantasy to reality, from imagining to doing. Even if it was only one step and would never go any further, the gap stretched like the distance between two mountains. The Sorting Hat had never offered her Gryffindor. Was it fair that thus a woman's life be judged?
"If you can't say it now, when you won't even remember it afterward, when nothing will continue from this moment, just as if you were to die, then when will you ever say it to anyone?" "Can I have a kiss first?"
said Rhian Felthorne. Snape's black eyes studied her so intensely that her blush started to reach all the way to her chest, and she wondered if he knew perfectly well that she was still being weak, and it wasn't a kiss she'd truly wanted.
"Why not?"
the potions master said quietly, and he leaned his head down over the sofa and kissed her. It was nothing like she had imagined. In her fantasies, Snape's kisses were fierce, seized from her. But this was... it was just... awkward, actually. Snape's lips pressed down too hard on hers, forcing them back against her teeth, and the angle wasn't right, and their noses were sort of bending, and his lips were too tight, and... Only as the potions master straightened back up again, raising his wand once more, did she realize. "That wasn't," she said in a wondering voice, looking up at him. "That wasn't... was it? Your first?" Rhiann Felthorn blinked at the stone cavern she'd discovered, still holding the extraordinary ruby she'd found embedded in the dirt of one corner. It was an incredible windfall, and she didn't know why looking at the ruby made her feel so sad, like she had forgotten something. Something that had been precious to her. Chapter 77. Self-Actualization Aftermaths. Surface Appearances. Aftermath. Albus Dumbledore and... The old wizard sat alone at his desk, in the unsilence of the headmaster's office, amid the innumerable and unnoted devices. His robes a gentle yellow of soft fabric, not such clothing as he ordinarily wore before others. His wrinkled hand held a quill, scratching away at an official-looking parchment. If you had somehow been there to watch his lined face, you would have been unable to deduce anything more about the man himself than you understood of the enigmatic devices. You might have observed that the face looked a little sad, a little tired, but then Albus Dumbledore always looked like that when he was alone. In the flue hearth there were only scattered ashes, without a hint of flame. A magical door that had been shut so solidly as to stop existing. On the material plane, the great oaken door to the office had been closed and locked. Beyond that door, the endless stairs stayed motionless. At the bottom of those stairs, the gargoyles that blocked the entrance did not flow, their pseudo-life withdrawn to leave solid rock. Then, even as the quill was in the middle of penning a word, even as it was in the middle of scratching a letter, the old wizard shot to his feet with a speed that would have shocked anyone watching, abandoning the quill in mid-letter to fall onto the parchment. Like lightning, he spun on the oaken door, his yellow robes whirling around him and a wand of dread power leaping into his hand. And as abruptly, the old wizard paused, halting his motion even as the wand came to bear. A hand struck upon the oaken door, 3 times knocking. More slowly now, that grim wand went back into the dueling holster strapped beneath the old wizard's sleeve. The ancient man moved forward a few paces, drew himself up into a more formal stance, composed his face. Nearby, upon the desk, the quill moved to the side of the parchment, as though it had been carefully placed there rather than dropped in haste, and the parchment itself flipped over to show blankness. With a silent twitch of his will, the oaken door swung open, hard as stones. The green eyes glared at him.
"I admit that I am impressed, Harry," the old wizard said quietly. "The cloak of invisibility would have let you evade my lesser means of vision, but I did not sense my golem step aside, nor the stairs turning. How did you come here?"
The boy walked into the office, step by deliberate step, until the door closed smoothly behind him.
"I can go anywhere I choose, with or without permission," the boy said.
His voice seemed calm. Too calm, perhaps.
"I am in your office because I decided to be here, and to hell with passwords. You are greatly mistaken, Headmaster Dumbledore, if you think that I stay in this school because I am a prisoner here. I simply have not chosen, yet, to leave. Now, keeping that in mind, why did you command your agent, Professor Snape, to break the agreement we made in this office, that he would not torment any student in her fourth year or below?"
The old wizard looked at the angry young hero for a long moment. Then, slowly enough not to alarm the boy, those wizened fingers drew open one of the manifold drawers of the desk, lifted out a sheet of parchment, laid it upon the desk.
14, the old wizard said. "It is not the number of all the owls sent last night, only the owls sent to families with a seat on the Wizengamot, or families of great wealth, or families already allied with your foes, or in the case of Robert Jugson, all three, for his father, Lord Jugson, is a Death Eater, and his grandfather a Death Eater who died by Alistair Moody's wand. What the letters said, I do not know, but I can guess. Do you still not understand, Harry Potter? Each time Hermione Granger won, as you put it, the danger to her from Slytherin grew again, and yet again. But now the Slytherins have triumphed over her, easily and safely, without violence or lasting harm. They have won, and need fight no more."
The old wizard sighed.
So I had planned. So I had hoped. So it would have been if the defense professor had not taken it upon himself to intervene. Now the dispute goes to the Board of Governors, where Severus will seem to conquer the defense professor. But that will not feel the same to the Slytherins. It will not have been over and finished in a moment, to their satisfaction.
The boy advanced further into the room, his head tilting back further to look up at the half-moon glasses. And somehow it was like the boy was looking down at the headmaster, rather than up.
"So this Lord Jugson is a Death Eater?"
the boy said softly.
"Good. His life is already bought and paid for, then, and I can do anything I want to him without ethical problems."
"Harry!"
The boy's voice was clear as ice, frozen of purest water from some untouched spring.
"You seem to think that the light should live in fear of the darkness. I say it should be the other way around. I'd prefer not to kill this Lord Jugson, even if he is a Death Eater. But 1 hour of brainstorming with the defense professor would be plenty of time to come up with some creative way to wreck him financially, or get him exiled from magical Britain. That would serve to make the point, I think."
"I confess,"
the old wizard said slowly,
"that the thought of ruining a 500-year-old house and challenging a Death Eater to war to the finish over a scuffle in a Hogwarts hallway had not occurred to me, Harry."
The old wizard lifted a finger to push back his half-moon glasses from where they had slid a little down his nose during his sudden motion earlier.
"I dare say it would not occur to Miss Granger either, nor to Professor McGonagall, nor to Fred and George."
The boy shrugged.
"It wouldn't be about the hallways," the boy said. "It would be justice for his past crimes, and I'd only do it if Jugson made the first move. The point isn't to make people scared of me as a wild card, after all. It's to teach them that neutrals are perfectly safe from me, and poking me with a stick is incredibly dangerous."
The boy smiled in a way that didn't reach his eyes.
"Maybe I'll buy an ad in the Daily Prophet, saying that anyone who wants to carry on this dispute with me will learn the true meaning of chaos, but anyone who leaves me alone will be fine."
"No,"
the old wizard said. His voice was deeper now, showing something of his true age and power.
"No, Harry, that must not be. You have not yet learned the meaning of fighting. What truly happens when foes meet in battle? And so you dream, as young boys do, of teaching your foes to fear you. It frightens me that you, at far too young an age, might already have enough power to make some part of your dreams into reality. There is no turning off that road which does not lead into darkness, Harry. None. That is the way of a Dark Lord, for certain."
The boy hesitated then, and his eyes flickered to the empty golden platform where Fawkes sometimes rested his wings. It was a gesture that few would have caught, but the old wizard knew it very well.
"All right, forget the part about teaching them to fear me,"
the boy said then. His voice was no less hard, but some of the cold had gone from it.
"I still don't think you should let children get hurt out of fear of what someone like Lord Jugson might do. Protecting them is the whole point of your job. If Lord Jugson really does try to get in your way, then do whatever it takes to stop him. Give me full access to my vaults, and I'll take personal responsibility for dealing with any fallout from banning bullies in Hogwarts, whether it's Lord Jugson or anyone else."
Slowly, the old wizard shook his head.
"You seem to think, Harry, that I need merely use my full power, and all foes will be swept aside. You are wrong. Lucius Malfoy controls Minister Fudge. Through the Daily Prophet, he sways all Britain. Only by bare margins does he not control enough of the Board of Governors to oust me from Hogwarts. Amelia Bones and Bartimus Crouch are allies, but even they would step aside if they saw us acting wantonly. The world that surrounds you is more fragile than you seem to believe, and we must walk with greater care. The old wizarding war never ended, Harry. It only continued in a different form. The Black King slept, and Lucius Malfoy moved his chess pieces from time to time. Do you think Lucius Malfoy would lightly permit you to take a pawn of his color?"
The boy smiled, now with a touch of coldness again.
Okay, I'll figure out some way to set it up so that it looks like Lord Jugson betrayed his own side.
Harry!
Obstacles mean you get creative, Headmaster. It doesn't mean you abandon the children you're supposed to protect. Let the light win, and if trouble comes of it...
The boy shrugged.
Let light win again!
So might phoenixes speak, if they had words,
the old wizard said.
But you do not understand the phoenix's price.
The last two words were spoken in a peculiarly clear voice that seemed to echo around the office. And then a huge rumbling noise seemed to come from all around them. Between the ancient shield on the wall and the Sorting Hat's hat rack, the stone of the walls began to flow and move, pouring itself into two framing columns and revealing a gap between them, an opening that showed a set of stone stairs leading upward into darkness. The old wizard turned and strode toward those stairs, and then looked back at where Harry Potter stood.
"Come,"
said the old wizard. There was no twinkle now in those blue eyes.
"Since you have already gone so far as to force your way here uninvited, you may as well go further."
There were no railings on those stone steps, and after the first few steps, Harry drew his wand and cast Lumos. The headmaster did not look back, did not seem to be looking downward, as though he had climbed the steps often enough to have no need of vision. The boy knew that he should have been curious, or frightened, but there was no spare brain capacity for that. It was taking all his control not to let the fury simmering inside him boil over any further than it already had. The stairs went on for only a short distance, one straight rising flight without turns or curves. At the top was a door of solid metal, looking black in the blue light cast from Harry's wand, meaning that the metal itself was either black or perhaps red. Albus Dumbledore lifted up his long wand like a brandished symbol, and again spoke in that strange voice which seemed to echo in Harry's ears, as though burning itself into his memory.
"Phoenix's fate."
That last door opened, and Harry followed Dumbledore inside. The room beyond seemed to be made of black metal, like the door that led to it. The walls were black. The floor was black. The ceiling above was black, but for a single globe of crystal that hung down from the ceiling on a white chain, and shone with a brilliant silver light that looked like it had been cast in imitation of Patronus light, though you could tell it wasn't the real thing. Within the room were pedestals of black metal, each bearing a moving picture, or an upright cylinder, half filled with some faintly shining silver liquid, or a lone small object. A scorched silver necklace, a crushed hat, an untouched golden wedding ring. Many pedestals bore all three: the moving picture and the silver liquid and the item. There seemed to be a good many wizards' wands upon those pedestals, and many of those wands were broken, or burned, or looked like the wood had somehow melted. It took that long for Harry to realize what he was seeing, and then his throat suddenly choked. It was like the rage inside him had been hit a hammer blow, maybe the hardest hammer blow of his entire existence.
These are not all the fallen of all my wars,
Albus Dumbledore said. His back was to Harry. Only his grey locks and yellowish robes showed.
Not even nearly all of them. Only my closest friends. And those who died of my worst decisions. There is something of them here. Those I regret most of all. This is their place.
Harry couldn't count how many pedestals were in the room. It might have been around 100. The room of black metal was not small, and there was clearly more space left in it for future pedestals. Albus Dumbledore turned and regarded Harry. The deep blue eyes set like steel in his brow. But his voice, when he spoke, was calm.
It seems to me that you know nothing of the Phoenix's price,
Albus Dumbledore said quietly.
It seems to me that you are not an evil person, but most terribly ignorant and confident in your ignorance, as I once was a long time ago. Yet I have never heard folk so clearly as you seemed to that day. Perhaps I was already too old and full of grief when my phoenix came to me. If there is something I do not understand about how ready I should be to fight, then tell me of this wisdom.
There was no anger in the old wizard's voice. The impact that drove out your breath like falling off a broomstick was all in the scorched and shattered ones, gleaming gently in their death beneath the silver light.
Or else turn and go from this place. But then I wish to hear no more of it.
Harry didn't know what to say. There had been nothing in his own life that was like this, and all the words seemed to fall away. He would find something to say if he looked, but he couldn't believe, in that moment, that the words would be meaningful. You shouldn't be able to win any possible argument just from people having died of your decisions. And yet, even knowing that, it felt like there was nothing to be said. That there was nothing Harry had any right to say. And Harry almost did turn and go from that place. Except for the understanding which came to him then. That there was probably a part of Albus Dumbledore which always stood in this place. Always. No matter where he was. And that if you stood in a place like this, you could do anything. Lose anything. If it meant that you didn't have to fight another time. One of the pedestals caught Harry's eye. The photograph on it didn't move, didn't smile or wave. It was a Muggle photograph of a woman looking seriously at the camera. Her brown hair twisted into braids of an ordinary Muggle style that Harry hadn't seen on any witch. There was a cylinder of silvery liquid beside the photograph, but no object. No melted ring or broken wand. Harry walked forward, slowly, until he stood before the pedestal.
Who was she?
Harry said, his voice sounding strange in his own ears.
Her name was Trisha Glasswell, said Dumbledore. The mother of a Muggle-born daughter, who the Death Eaters killed. She was a detective of the Muggle government, and after that she fed information from the Muggle authorities to the Order of the Phoenix. Until she was betrayed into the hands of Voldemort.
There was a catch in the old wizard's voice.
She did not die well, Harry.
Did she save lives?
Harry said.
Yes,
the wizard said quietly.
She did.
Harry lifted his gaze from the pedestal to look at Dumbledore.
Would the world be a better place if she hadn't fought?
No, it would not,
said the old wizard. His voice was tired and grieving. He seemed more bent now, as though he were folding in on himself.
I see that you still do not understand. I think you will not understand until the day that you... Oh, Harry, so very long ago, when I was not much older than you are now, I learned the true face of violence and its cost. To fill the air with deadly curses, for any reason, for any reason, Harry. It is an ill thing, and its nature is corrupted, as terrible as the darkest rituals. Violence, once begun, becomes like a lethargy that strikes at any life near it. I would spare you that lesson the way I learned it, Harry.
Harry looked away from the blue eyes, cast his gaze down at the black metal of the floor. The headmaster was trying to tell him something important, that was clear, and it wasn't something that Harry thought was stupid either.
There was a Muggle once named Mahatma Gandhi,
Harry said to the floor.
He thought the government of Muggle Britain shouldn't rule over his country, and he refused to fight. He convinced his whole country not to fight. Instead, he told his people to walk up to the British soldiers and let themselves be struck down, without resisting. And when Britain couldn't stand doing that anymore, we freed his country. I thought it was a very beautiful thing, when I read about it. I thought it was something higher than all the wars that anyone had ever fought with guns or swords. That they'd really done that, and that it had actually worked.
Harry drew another breath.
Only then I found out that Gandhi told his people, during World War II, that if the Nazis invaded, they should use non-violent resistance against them too. But the Nazis would have just shot everyone in sight. And maybe Winston Churchill always felt that there should have been a better way, some clever way to win without having to hurt anyone. But he never found it, and so he had to fight.
Harry looked up at the headmaster, who was staring at him.
Winston Churchill was the one who tried to convince the British government not to give Czechoslovakia to Hitler in exchange for a peace treaty, that they should fight right away.
I recognize the name, Harry, said Dumbledore.
The old wizard's lips twitched upward.
Although honesty compels me to say that dear Winston was never one for pangs of conscience, even after a dozen shots of fire whiskey.
The point is,
Harry said after a brief pause to remember exactly who he was talking to, and fight down the sudden returning sense that he was an ignorant child gone insane with audacity, who had no right to be in this room, and no right to question Albus Dumbledore about anything.
The point is, saying violence is evil isn't an answer. It doesn't say when to fight and when not to fight. It's a hard question, and Gandhi refused to deal with it, and that's why I lost some of my respect for him.
And your own answer, Harry?
Dumbledore said quietly.
One answer is that you shouldn't ever use violence except to stop violence,
Harry said.
You shouldn't risk anyone's life except to save even more lives. It sounds good when you say it like that. Only the problem is that if a police officer sees a burglar robbing a house, the police officer should try to stop the burglar, even though the burglar might fight back and someone might get hurt or even killed. Even if the burglar is only trying to steal jewellery, which is just a thing, because if nobody so much as inconveniences burglars, there'll be more burglars and more burglars. And even if they only ever stole things each time, it would... the fabric of society...
Harry stopped. His thoughts weren't as ordered as they usually pretended to be in this room. He should have been able to give some perfectly logical exposition in terms of game theory, should have at least been able to see it that way. But it was eluding him. Hawks and doves.
Don't you see? If evil people are willing to risk violence to get what they want, and good people always back down because violence is too terrible to risk, it's not a good society to live in, Headmaster. Don't you realize what all this bullying is doing to Hogwarts? To Slytherin House, most of all.
War is too terrible to risk,
the old wizard said.
And yet it will come. Voldemort is returning. The black chess pieces are gathering. Severus is one of the most important pieces our own side possesses in that war. But our evil potions master must, as the saying goes, keep up appearances. If Severus can pay that keep by hurting the feelings of children, only their feelings, Harry.
The old wizard's voice was very soft.
You would have to be most terribly innocent in the ways of war to think he'd made a poor bargain. Hard decisions do not look like that, Harry. They look like this.
The old wizard did not gesture. He simply stood where he was, among the pedestals.
You shouldn't be headmaster,
Harry said through the burning in his throat.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. But you shouldn't try to be a school principal and run a war at the same time. Hogwarts shouldn't be part of this.
The children will survive,
the old wizard said with tired old eyes.
They would not survive, Voldemort. Have you wondered why the children of Hogwarts do not speak much of their parents, Harry? It is because there is always, within earshot, someone who has lost their mother, or father, or both. That is what Voldemort left behind the last time he came. Nothing is worth that war beginning again, even
one day earlier than it must, or lasting one day longer than it must.
The old wizard did gesture now, as though to indicate all the shattered ones.
We did not fight because it seemed righteous to do so. We fought when we had to, when there was no other way left. That was our answer.
Is that why you waited so long to confront Grindelwald?
Harry had uttered the question without quite thinking. There was a slow time while the blue eyes searched him.
Who have you been talking to, Harry?
Said the old wizard.
No, do not answer. I already know.
Dumbledore sighed.
Many have asked me that question, and as always I have turned them aside. Yet, in time you must learn the full truth of that matter. Will you swear never to speak of it to another, unless I give you leave?
Harry would have liked to be allowed to tell Draco, but...
I swear, Harry said.
Grindelwald possessed an ancient and terrible device, said Dumbledore. While he held it, I could not break his defense. In our duel, I could not win, only fight him for long hours until he fell in exhaustion. And I would have died of it afterward, if not for Fawkes. But while his Muggle allies yet made blood sacrifices to sustain him, Grindelwald would not have fallen. He was, during that time, truly invincible. Of that grim device which Grindelwald held, none must know, none must suspect. There must not be a single hint. And therefore you must not speak of it, and I will say no more for now. That is all, Harry. There is no moral to it, and no wisdom. That is all there is.
Harry slowly nodded. It wasn't entirely implausible, by the standards of magic.
And then...
Dumbledore's voice went on, even quieter, almost as though he were speaking to himself.
Since it was I who felled him, they obeyed me when I said he should not die, though they cried by the thousands for his blood. So he was imprisoned in Nurmengard, in the prison that he built, and he abides there until this day. I went to that duel without any intent to kill him, Harry, because, you see, I had tried to kill Grindelwald once before, a long time ago, and that was... It proved to be a mistake, Harry.
The old wizard was staring now at his long, dark, grey wand where he held it in both hands, as though it were a crystal ball out of Muggle fantasy, a scrying pool within which answers could be found.
And I thought then, I thought that I should never kill. And then came Voldemort.
The old wizard looked back up at Harry and said in a hoarse voice,
"He is not like Grindelwald, Harry. There is nothing human left in him. Him you must destroy. You must not hesitate when the time comes. To him alone, of all the creatures in this world, you must show no mercy. And when you are done, you must forget it. Forget that you ever did such a thing, and go back to living.
Save your fury for that, and that alone."
In that office there was silence. It lasted for some many long seconds, and finally was broken by a single question.
"Are there Dementors in Nirmengard?"
"What?" said the old wizard. "No, I would not have done that, even to him."
The old wizard stared at the young boy, who had straightened, and his face changed.
"In other words," the boy said, as though talking to himself without any other people in the room, "it's already known how to keep powerful dark wizards in prison without using Dementors. People know. They know that."
"Harry."
"No,"
the boy said. The boy looked up, and his eyes were blazing like green fire.
"I do not accept your answer, Headmaster. Fawkes gave me a mission, and I know now why Fawkes gave that mission to me and not you. You're willing to accept balances of power where the bad guys end up winning, and I'm not."
"That too is not an answer,"
the old wizard said. His face showed nothing of his hurt. He had long practice in concealing pain.
"Refusing to accept something does not change it. I wonder now if you are simply too young to understand this matter, Harry, despite your outward airs. Only in children's fantasies can all battles be won, and not a single evil tolerated."
"And that's why I can destroy Dementors and you can't," said the boy. "Because I believe that the darkness can be broken."
The old wizard's breath stopped in his throat.
"The Phoenix Price isn't inevitable," the boy said. "It's not part of some deep balance built into the universe. It's just the parts of the problem where you haven't figured out yet how to cheat."
The old wizard's lips parted, and no words came forth. Silver light falling on shattered wands.
"Fawkes gave me a mission," the boy repeated. "And I will carry out that mission if I must break the entire ministry to do it. That's the part of the answer that you're missing. You don't stop and say, 'Oh, well, I guess I can't possibly figure out any way to stop bullying in Hogwarts,' and leave it at that. You just keep looking until you figure out how to do it. If that requires breaking Lucius Malfoy's entire conspiracy, fine."
"And the true fight? The fight against Voldemort?"
the old wizard said in an unsteady voice.
"What will you do to win that, Harry? Will you break the whole world? Even if someday you gain such power, you are not yet beyond prices, and perhaps you never will be. For you to act this way now is nothing short of madness."
"I asked Professor Quirrell why he had laughed," the boy said evenly, "after he awarded Hermione those 100 points. And Professor Quirrell said, these aren't his exact words, but it's pretty much what he said, that he'd found it tremendously amusing that the great and good Albus Dumbledore had been sitting there doing nothing as this poor innocent girl begged for help, and while he had been the one to defend her. And he told me then that by the time good and moral people were done tying themselves up in knots, what they usually did was nothing. Or if they did act, you could hardly tell them apart from the people called bad. Whereas he could help innocent girls any time he felt like it, because he wasn't a good person. And that I ought to remember that any time I considered growing up to be good."
The old wizard did not show the force of the blow. Only a slight widening of his eyes would have betrayed it, if you'd been watching him very closely.
"Don't worry, Headmaster," said the boy. "I haven't gotten my wires crossed. I know that I'm supposed to learn goodness from Hermione and Forks, not from Professor Quirrell and you. Which brings me to the actual reason why I came here. Hermione's time is too valuable to waste in detentions. Professor Snape will revoke it, claiming that I blackmailed him."
After a hesitation, the old wizard nodded his head, the silver beard swaying slowly beneath.
"That would not be best for her, Harry," the old wizard said. "But the detention can be put down as being served with Professor Binns, and you and she can study together in his classroom."
"Fine," the boy said. "I think that was all the business we had together in the end. You may expect, the next time you seem to be working on the side of the bad guys, or letting them win, that I will do whatever I think Forks would tell me to, regardless of how much trouble comes of it. I hope we're both clear on that."
Without another word, the boy turned and walked out of the room, through the open door of black metal. The word,
"Lumos!"
and the light of his wand following a moment later. The old wizard stood there silent. Silent amid the ruins of the light.